When are big ventricles a concern? I mean, we get some sort of head imaging on nearly any patient we see in neurology. How much space is too much space? Jim Sigler here for the Brainwaves podcast, and this week on the program, idiopathic normal pressure hydrocephalus. The reality, the controversy, the management. Stay with us. So jumping right into things, let's just acknowledge the differential diagnosis for NPH. Then we'll use this to segue into the diagnostic criteria, the clinical features, the treatment options, and the prognosis. So first, the differential diagnosis. It's almost always radiographic when you're suspecting NPH. You don't really see neurologists clinically diagnosing idiopathic NPH. You get the imaging and you see large lateral ventricles. What you want to be sure you rule out are the obstructive causes of hydrocephalus, in which case you might see significant transependymal flow and compression of the cerebral aqueduct or the fourth ventricle. You'll want to rule out other causes of communicating hydrocephalus, as might be seen in inflammatory and neoplastic disorders like carcinomatous meningitis and neurosarcoidosis. And you'll want to rule out major causes of diffuse brain atrophy, like Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia, or other neurodegenerative conditions. In particular, dementia with Lewy bodies and PSP may be tough to parse out because these patients have cognitive impairment and a movement disorder, just like NPH. But once you rule out these other disorders, you've got the imaging, and it's a communicating hydrocephalus, and they have normal intracranial pressure, and they're an adult, then you've probably got NPH. Experts then divide NPH into primary and secondary causes. Primary meaning idiopathic, and secondary meaning as a consequence of some other neurologic process. Most commonly, this would be things like head trauma, meningitis, or subarachnoid hemorrhage. If you figure this out based on the history, then you'll feel more confident about your diagnosis, and then also about the patient's probability that they're going to respond to shunt surgery. Clinically, when we think about NPH, we think about the three W's: wet, wacky, and wobbly. Wet because of urinary incontinence due to impairment of micturition centers of the frontal lobes. Wacky because NPH is one of the reversible causes of dementia. And wobbly because of the characteristic magnetic gait and imbalance. And this can be distinguished from Parkinsonism on the basis of normal gait initiation and lack of the festinating gait features that you see with PD. That being said, 11% of patients with NPH have Parkinsonism. But you don't have to have all those three features, the wet, wacky, and wobbly. And rarely do they ever all three occur in the same patient. Usually only when the disease has reached a critical tipping point. So you should suspect the disorder on the basis of any one of these symptoms, particularly in a patient who presents with the chief complaint of a progressive cognitive impairment, since NPH is one of those reversible dementia syndromes. Most commonly, patients present to the outpatient clinic with a gait disturbance, the wobbly part of the three W's, and they'll probably not have any other neurologic symptoms, making it difficult to localize. They may say that they're walking more slowly than they used to. They have trouble climbing stairs or walking up or down hills, or maybe they have difficulty getting out of a chair, almost as if they have a proximal myopathy. When these patients walk, in the worst case scenario, they may look like their feet are glued to the ground. Their stride length is short, and steps are slow, with a reduced foot floor clearance. Some describe this gait as magnetic. In addition to their gait disturbance, we think of NPH as one of the subcortical dementias. This is the wacky part of the three W's. And NPH may be responsible for as many as 1 in 20 of all adult cognitive disorders. I think a key feature of NPH when considering it to be the cause of somebody's dementia is that the cognitive aspect is rarely the only neurologic manifestation. Usually, if it's NPH, the patient will have some kind of cognitive disturbance, as well as gait impairment or urinary incontinence. When you see the cognitive impairment in isolation, it should make you think of other causes of dementia. So what are the discognitive features of NPH, and what do I mean by a subcortical dementia? Patients with subcortical dementia have slower processing, or bradyphrenia. It takes them longer to find the word that they wanted to say, or to think through a problem. These patients can be forgetful, having slower recall, or they have difficulty following multi-step commands. And this is all in contrast to the cortical features of dementia, which are characterized by aphasia, memory loss, agnosia, and apraxia. So anyway, patients with NPH have more of these subcortical features, and they may also have more neuropsychiatric manifestations, particularly depression. And you should always be screening for this in each of your patients who come in with cognitive impairment, because depression is also one of those pseudo-dementing illnesses. And not to mention that patients with NPH may also respond to antidepressants. The third and the last of the W's is for wet, meaning incontinence of urine. This is characteristically a later feature of NPH, and it may not be part of that triad that you see in most patients. Rather, some patients may have urgency or frequency. Or when you have gait impairment, the patient may also have a functional incontinence because they just can't reach the toilet in time. From an anatomic consideration, urinary frequency and urgency are the result of CSF infiltrating those periventricular nerve fiber spaces in the frontal lobes, which then inhibit the descending bladder contraction signals. And clinically, this may be indistinguishable from prostate issues in your male patients or recurrent UTIs in females. So often, a urology referral may be helpful to perform urodynamic studies and confirm your suspicion. Knowing these symptoms and their variability, what are the diagnostic criteria for NPH? Well, there aren't really any diagnostic criteria like there are for patients who have multiple sclerosis or myasthenia gravis. If anything, there are going to be those clinical and neuroimaging features that you should check that would rule out other causes of gait disturbance or cognitive impairment, or features that could raise your suspicion for NPH. You should consider cervical or thoracic spine imaging in a patient who comes in with progressive gait impairment and incontinence to look for a myelopathy. Does your patient have reduced reflexes and a peripheral neuropathy as a cause of their gait disturbance? Should you check for those labs? Does your patient have temporal atrophy to suggest mesial temporal sclerosis or Alzheimer's disease? After you consider all these things, the imaging and the response to CSF removal are crucial for your confirmation of NPH. And radiographically, as you might know, NPH is characterized by the enlargement of lateral ventricles with or without transependymal flow, meaning there's a signal change in that periventricular white matter where the CSF is trying to escape. On imaging, it looks kind of like a blend between the signal of CSF and the signal of the white matter, almost like what you see in microvascular disease. To quantitate this, we use the Evans index, or the Evans ratio. And to measure this, you're going to take the axial MRI or the head CT and measure the widest part of the anterior horns of the lateral ventricles and divide this distance over the widest distance of the inner table of the skull. Just Google Evans index if you're having trouble imagining this. An Evans index of more than 0.3 is sufficient to diagnose ventriculomegaly. And with normal brain volume, that's pretty easy to do. As patients get older, though, there can be a global atrophy. And you see this with Alzheimer's in particular. So the ventriculomegaly may be related to other causes as well, which is why it's always important to perform a thorough neuroassessment to exclude those other conditions, especially since these patients are not going to respond to shunt surgery. But what other imaging markers are out there? Some neuroimaging experts like flow-sensitive T2-weighted MRI sequences, which can show a flow void in the cerebral aqueduct for some patients. And typically, this means that a patient's going to respond to shunt surgery. So it's a good neuroimaging biomarker for that. In addition to these clinical and neuroimaging markers, perhaps the most important marker lies in the treatment. Does this patient respond to CSF removal? How I've typically done this is that I put the patient through a large volume LP, and I remove 30 to 50 cc's of CSF. The patient will take a 25-step walk test before and then a few minutes after the LP is done, and if there's any improvement in the gait after the tap, then there's a high probability, well, for one thing, that the patient does have NPH, and second, that the patient may respond to chronic CSF shunting. Studies have shown that this response to large volume taps is a highly sensitive test to predict responsiveness to shunting, meaning that if you see it, the patient should respond to shunt surgery. But the specificity is fairly low, on the order of 40%. So that means that a patient may have NPH on the basis of clinical or radiographic features, and they may still respond to shunt surgery. But if you do that large volume tap, then they may not necessarily improve in the office. More predictive than this TAP test is a test of prolonged external lumbar drainage. And to do this, patients are usually admitted to the hospital for 24 to 72 hours, and a lumbar drain is placed, usually draining 10 cc's an hour or so. Patients are monitored for improvements in their gait and cognitive testing, and when you compare the positive predictive value for the TAP test, which is still 72% predictive of a response to permanent shunting, this extended lumbar drain assessment carries a 91% positive predictive response to shunting. Although the inconvenience of hospital admission and the risk of meningitis and hematomas may not be worth it for some. So once you've made the diagnosis, or at least you have a reasonable suspicion for NPH, what can you do about it? Well, I've already mentioned a few times that NPH is one of those reversible causes of dementia, along with things like thiamine and B12 deficiency, neurosyphilis, hypothyroidism, depression. But that being said, the dementia that we see in NPH is not all that reversible. Since the only real treatment is the shunt surgery, in which a lumbar drain is placed and connected to the abdominal cavity to permanently siphon out that CSF, we should really strive to identify which patients will respond to shunting. And it turns out, patients with severe dementia from NPH, they're the ones that don't respond that well to shunting. That part doesn't get much better. If a patient had a secondary NPH, meaning NPH from a prior subarachnoid hemorrhage, for example, that patient may respond more to shunting, and they may have some cognitive or gait improvement. In patients with a shorter duration of symptoms, or symptoms limited only to gait impairment, those patients also typically get better with shunting. And here lies the controversy. So the original description for NPH was made in 1965 by Adams and colleagues, and they called it symptomatic occult hydrocephalus, and they described patients with gait disturbance and ventriculomegaly whose CSF pressure was normal. 50 years later, we still don't know what causes it. At autopsy, there appears to be nothing structurally wrong with the brain. No histopathologic evidence for other causes of dementia or neurodegeneration. There's no way that we could definitively say that one brain was from a patient with NPH and another brain was from a patient who was healthy. The only way that we could even try to prove that it's a distinct neurologic condition is by treating it. If you shunt a patient who has Alzheimer's disease and they have ex vacuo ventricular dilatation, nothing's going to get better. But if you shunt a patient with NPH, they may experience symptomatic improvement. So something's got to be there if an intervention results in a clinical response. At least that's the argument. Skeptics would contend that the response to treatment's variable, that we can never predict how someone might respond after being shunted. They might say things like, you never know who's going to improve, or maybe it's a placebo response. Well, that could be the case, but what I can tell you is that the researchers who have dedicated their lives to researching this question have found some patient-level factors that can predict a response to shunting, and with a high degree of accuracy. Younger age, for example. Probably because there's a lower probability that the patient's dementia is due to other neurodegenerative conditions. Shorter duration of symptoms. Fewer medical comorbidities. And less cerebral microvascular disease, which may also cause similar neuroimaging abnormalities and mimic NPH. So these patients, the relatively healthier ones, these are the folks who are most likely to have NPH, or at least they're the ones who are most likely to symptomatically benefit from shunt surgery. Now here comes some more data on the controversy. How long is that improvement? According to a 2001 meta-analysis, approximately two-thirds of patients who undergo shunt surgery experience some sort of improvement. And we saw this in the recently published randomized results of the Symphony 2 trial from 2015. Long-term benefits did dwindle with time, and maybe only one-third of patients had lasting improvement. And when I'm talking about improvement, I mean mostly with walking. Of patients who improved with shunt surgery, 9 out of 10 saw some sort of gait improvement, whereas the cognitive and urinary issues are much less likely to get better with shunting. And this may make any intervention seem futile to some people, but compare it to standards of care for other neurologic conditions. Anticholinesterase inhibitors for Alzheimer's disease, for example. Fewer than half of patients derive any benefit at all, and this hardly results in meaningful improvements. But if a patient with NPH undergoes shunt surgery, their walking may get a lot better, at least for a short period of time. So while this condition may seem a little cryptic to some clinicians, or the diagnosis is controversial, or you don't really believe in the treatment, or you think the treatment offers relatively limited improvement, there's still much to learn from your patient during the workup and during the course of their therapy. And who knows, maybe you'll find that they have dementia with Lewy bodies, or with follow-up testing you find that they just have Parkinson's disease and they respond really well to dopamine agonists. So I wouldn't just quit after a routine head CT in a patient who comes in with cognitive impairment and you think it may be dementia. There are potentially treatable causes out there, and NPH is one of them. And with that, I think we'll wrap up the show. Thanks so much for joining us this week. If you like what you heard, or you think you learned something, let us know by rating the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you get your shows. The Brainwaves Podcast is produced at a Studio 3 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I'm Jim Siegler, the senior producer. Music for this program was courtesy of Ghost, John Watts, Julie Maxwell, Coma Q, and Kevin McLeod. Sound effects by Mike Koenig and Daniel Simeone, all under a Creative Commons license. For more information, follow us on Twitter at Brainwaves Audio or Facebook at facebook.com/brainwavesaudio. And let us know if you have any topic recommendations or ways we can improve the show. I'm Jim Siegler. Thanks for listening.